This is lecture number 8 on the Major Prophets by Robert Vinoy. Lecture number 8, and we are continuing on his lectures on Isaiah in Major Prophets. Again, lecture number 8. We're still in the book of Emmanuel, which is Isaiah chapters 7 to 12. We concluded chapter 10 at the end of the last hour, so we move on to chapter 11 this morning. Remember, chapter 10 ended with the cutting down, you might say, of the forest of Assyria. That's figurative language at the end, but you see, you have from verse 28 the advance of the Assyrians from town to town until they come to Jerusalem, and that's verse 32. Verse 32 says, and I quote, "He shall shake his hand against the mount of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem." That's Assyria shaking the hand. But then we have the Lord's intervention. And I quote again, "The Lord shall lock the bow with terror. The high ones of stature shall be hewn down. The haughty shall be humbled. He shall cut down the thickets of the forest with iron. Lebanon shall fall by a mighty one." End quote. So at the end of chapter 10, you have the cutting down of Assyria. Now at the beginning of chapter 11, you have a contrast to that in this sense. Assyria falls not to rise again, and by 612 BC, Nineveh is destroyed and Assyria is gone. But in contrast to that, the kingdom of David, which is also cut down, after all, Israel or Judah goes into exile, and is not destroyed ever to rise again, but rather it's going to send forth a new shoot. The stump is left. It's still alive. And so you read in chapter 11, verse 1, quote, "There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse. A branch shall grow out of its roots." End quote. Even though judgment also comes to Judah, and again using the imagery of the tree, Judah is cut down, there is still life, and the Lord sends forth a branch, the shoot, from the stump. So God's people were punished, but they were not completely destroyed, as was the case with Assyria. Now, chapter 11, verse 1 is a very well-known verse in the Old Testament. Quote, "There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse," end quote, and clearly this is a messianic reference. That becomes clear as you get into verse 2, because you see that verse 2 speaks as if this rod and this branch is a person, and it is a person who is endued with the power of the Spirit. Quote, "And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord." End quote. And as you go down through the chapter, verses 2 to 10 describe the results of the coming forth of this branch. And that can be broken down into two further sections. Verses 2 to 5 speak of his endowment by the Spirit and his actions, and verses 6 to 10 describe the characteristics of his kingdom. So let's look at the chapter with that structure in mind. As I already mentioned, verse 2 speaks of the branch's endowment by the Spirit. If you go back earlier in the book of Isaiah, in chapter 4, verse 2, which I suggested should be taken in a messianic sense, chapter 4, verse 2 is this: "That day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious. And remember that the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and splendid." That's basically what we have in chapter 4, verse 2. And here there's at least a hint of the deity, that is, the branch of the Lord, the deity of the coming Messiah. That becomes a bit more explicit. Chapter 7, verse 14. "The virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel, God with us." So deity is certainly brought into view in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. And then, in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, we read, "For unto us a child is given, and he shall be called by these great names, Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God," and certainly we have to say there is deity in those names. So in chapter 4, verse 2, chapter 7, verse 14, chapter 9, verse 6, all of which are messianic, and you have the idea of deity. Deity here in chapter 11, verse 1, is not so much in view or stress, but what is stressed here is infilling with the Holy Spirit and the righteousness of the branch's actions. So the picture begins to fill out of the coming Messiah. You notice in verse 2, there are six different aspects of the power of the Holy Spirit. Now, I'm not going to spend time on them, but the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, that's 2, the Spirit of counsel and might, that's 2 more, and the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord, that also is 2 more, and group them all together, and we have a total of 6 aspects of the power of the Spirit. Well, then verse 3, we have the righteousness of his judgments. Quote, the Spirit shall make him of quick understanding in the fear of the Lord, and he shall not judge after the sight of the eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor. End quote. It's not a superficial judgment that he will be making. It's not a judgment according to appearances, that is, with the sight of the eyes. But with righteousness he will judge the poor and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth, and he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth. So verse 3 speaks of the righteousness of the branches of judgment. Recall John chapter 2, verse 25. It says of Jesus that he knew all that was in man, and that same aspect of his view here was in view when John wrote chapter 2, verse 25, I'm sure. Now, verse 4 is the only verse that speaks of his activities, and when you read verse 4, the things that are spoken of seem to be things that are characteristic of a powerful ruler rather than of a teacher. Verse 4 seems to center on things that really have not yet been done by Christ. For he came at his first advent as a suffering servant, indeed as a teacher, but he will come at his second advent as a ruler. You see, verse 4 says, quote, with righteousness he shall judge the poor and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth, and he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. And I think the things that are in view here are things that will take place at Jesus' second coming rather than at his first coming. And I think that understanding of the verse is confirmed by 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8, where Paul makes a verse in Isaiah, when Paul says in 2 Thessalonians, again chapter 2, verse 8, quote, and then shall that wicked one be revealed when the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming, end quote. Paul here is looking to the future beyond his own time, that is, beyond the time that he writes 2 Thessalonians, and he speaks at some time in the future when he says, quote, the wicked one will be revealed whom the Lord will consume with the spirit of his mouth, or breath of his mouth, spirit being an Old English term that can be the same as breath. Now, Paul then sees the slaying of the wicked one by the breath of the Lord's mouth, or by the spirit of his mouth, as I mentioned earlier. So by the spirit of his mouth, by the breath of his lips, this is something that has not yet occurred in Paul's own day. I think Paul's quotation of this also helps us in another way. When you read in the last phrase of chapter 4, quote, with the breath of his lips, he shall slay the wicked, end quote, in English, that suggests that he'll slay everyone who is wicked, that he'll slay the wicked. The phrase seems to be a collective, but not necessarily, although it could be understood as a collective in the way that it is worded in English. In English, when an adjective is used as a substantive, it implies a plural. So, quote, he shall slay the wicked, end quote. But the interesting thing is, when Paul alludes to this verse, he uses the singular. And it's speaking of something that was to occur yet future to his own time, that is Paul's time. He says, then shall that wicked one be revealed whom the Lord will consume with the spirit of his mouth. The wicked one. The Hebrew would allow it to go either way, either as a singular or a plural, but Paul explicitly makes it a singular, and the wicked one, in the Greek, there's Paul's allusion to this verse, and in Greek, this is the word anomo, indicates an individual is being referred to, that is, the lawless one. The wicked one, the King James translates it. And so we have, the wicked one shall be revealed whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth. Now, let's take that phrase, spirit of his mouth. In the Greek, there is pneumati. In the Hebrew, it's ruach. The King James says there, with the breath of his lips. or I think it would have been better to keep pneumati, which is the Greek for spirit or breath, as breath, and you should translate this word that appears in both places the same way. You can equally translate it as breath or spirit or wind, but it would have been better to keep the translation constant. But I think that the main thing about the New Testament allusion to chapter 11, verse 4, is that we are led by that clearly to understand that verse 4 is referring to something that's yet future, future to the time of Paul, and presumed to our own time, and that is the Antichrist. It's also possible, as far as an allusion, it is less clear and the wording is not as explicit, but if you go to Revelation 19, you notice in the passage beginning at verse 11, quote, I saw heaven open, and behold, there was a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful, True, and Righteousness. He does judge and make war. His eyes are like flames of fire, and so forth. And then in verse 15 of Revelation chapter 19, John says, quote, out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, and with it he should smite the nations and should rule them with a rod of iron, end quote. We have this idea of the mouth of the Lord, and what goes forth from the mouth is going to slay the wicked ones. Here is plural, it's nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, a similar idea, and certainly the Isaiah passage, no direct quotation here, but the Isaiah been in the background of what is said in Revelation chapter 19, verse 15. Yes, it's plural, it is plural. But verse 21 says, and a remnant were slain with the sword of him, with the sword of Adam that sat on the horse, which the sword proceeded out of his mouth, and all the fowls were filled with their flesh, that is, of the wicked. But I think the Thessalonians' allusion to Isaiah 11:4 is certainly much clearer than the Revelation 19 allusion. Okay, so this first section, chapter 11, verses 2 to 5, described his endowment by the Spirit and his actions. Verses 6 to 9 describe the character of his kingdom. Verses 6 to 9 is a well-known section of Isaiah chapter 11. I quote, the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them, and the cow and the bear shall feed their young ones. The lion shall eat straw like an ox, and the nursing child shall play in the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den, and they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. End quote. The character of his kingdom, verses 6 to 9. Verse 9 sums up the facts, as you might say. Verse 9 says, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Now, it seems to me that verse 9 suggests that the picture here is the removal of external danger brought about through the reign of the Messiah. Yes, the removal of external danger brought about through the reign of the Messiah. Notice, they shall not hurt or destroy, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord, is what it says. It would seem that the reference here is to the same period of time that's referred to, verses 2 to 4, when, we read, swords will be beaten into plowshares. And then, in the parallel Micah passage, it says, every man shall sit under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be nothing to make them afraid. So again we see, it appears to be a removal of external danger here. God says that there will come a time on this earth when no one need fear injury from external attack, and that time will be established by this ruler who is to come, this divine ruler. Now, having said as much, there's still a question, and that question is, how do we understand the specifics of verse 9? Is that to be taken literally, or is it figurative? The wolf dwelling with the lamb, the leopard with the kid, the cow and the bear shall feed, all those specifics. Now, it seems to me, whether you take it figuratively or literally, it is difficult to deny that what it tells us is of a time where danger is removed, and where there are conditions of external peace and safety. That seems to be the point of the whole thing. I think that can be understood, even if it is a figurative description of a time where there is removal of danger and where there is peace and safety. Now, the period is normally referred to as the millennium, of course, taken from Revelation chapter 20, which is an indication that Satan will be bound for 1,000 years. I'm not so sure personally I'd push 1,000 years exactly. That too might be figurative for just a very long time. I don't know that it need be precisely 1,000 years, particularly in that kind of literature, that is apocalyptic literature, but certainly a long period of time of peace and safety, maybe 1,000 years, and maybe for a longer time, but something like that is in view. Isaiah gives no indication of the length of this period. He just says that there is the time to come when this rod out of the stem of Jesse is going to rule, and these conditions of peace, are going to be brought into him. Now, to get back to that question of literal or figurative, let's look at your citation on page 14. I have some paragraphs here from John Oswald. I guess it's Oswald or Oswalt, I'm not sure. But this is the New International Commentary volume on Isaiah, chapters 1 to 39. It came out a couple years ago, and it seems to be quite a good piece of work. But notice that Oswald says here, and I'm quoting, "There are three ways of interpreting such statements." And then he's talking about verses 6 to 9, you understand. I continue, "The first is literalistic, looking for a literal fulfillment of the words. While this interpretation is possible, the fact that the lion's carnivorousness is fundamental to what a lion is, and that literal fulfillment of the prophecy would require a basic alteration of the lion's nature, that suggests that another interpretation is needed." I end his quote here. So he says, you have to weigh the Old Testament statements about the Messiah as have been interpreted by the church. And so he says, one, the first way is literalistic. The second means of interpretation, he says, is spiritualistic. The animals represent various spiritual conditions and states within human beings. In other words, you're not even talking about animals here. While this avoids the problem of literal fulfillment, I think it does introduce a host of other problems, chief of which is the absence in the text of any controls upon this process of interpretation. Thus, it depends solely upon the exegete's ingenuity to find the correspondence. Contra chapter 5, verse 1 to 7, that's the passage where Israel is like a vineyard, where the correspondence is clearly indicated, and that correspondence is figurative, but we know exactly what it's referring to. And a third way of interpreting this passage, and others like it, is just figurative. In this approach, one concludes that an extended figure, or metaphor, if you like, of speech is being used to make a single overarching point, namely that the Messiah's reign is going to be one where we're going to have no fear, we're going to dwell securely, danger will be gone, and evil will be removed, and not only for the individual, but for the world as well. See, for example, Romans chapter 8, verses 19 to 21, where creation travails and groans, but those travails and groans will be done away with. Precisely how God may choose to do this in his infinite creativity is his will to decide, but that he will do so we may confidently believe. And so that is what Oswald suggests in these three ways that we might be able to interpret things. Now he opts for that third one. Notice the distinction between his spiritualistic approach and the figurative, as he labels them. Now, a few comments on that. If you take this section literally, you certainly have an idea introduced that is not found in either Isaiah chapter 2 or Micah chapter 4, and that is the idea that the animal creation is going to share in these conditions of peace and safety in a way which would radically alter their behavior and maybe even their physiology. Some have suggested that that's what is spoken of here, and that might be a return to the conditions of the Garden of Eden before the fall into sin, which is an interesting idea, but is it really germane? You do find in the early chapters of Genesis that all those animals were brought to Adam and he named them. There's no indication of hostility between Adam and the animals, or even between the animals and the animals, although there's not a lot of detail there. It just says that the Lord brought the animals, and Adam named them. And there was not found among them one like unto himself, that is, like Adam, and so Eve was created to be his mate. That seems somewhat attractive. However, if you understand it that way, it raises the question of death in the animal kingdom prior to the fall into sin. Was there death in the animal kingdom prior to the fall? It seems to me, when you reflect on that question, it seems quite likely that there was death in the animal kingdom prior to the fall into sin. I have in your bibliography, I think at this point, at the bottom of page 2, a book by Daniel Wanderley called God's Time Records in Ancient Sediments. I'm sure it's in the library, probably also in the bookstore. And there's an appendix in that book on pages 236 to 240 entitled, quote, The Problem of Death Before the Fall, end quote. He goes into that in some detail and I think makes a good case for concluding that there was death in the animal kingdom before the fall. Death itself in the animal kingdom was not part of the curse as far as the effects of human sin. You know, Romans 5 says that by sin of one man death entered the world, death by sin. Now that seems to be referring to the human race, not necessarily to the animal kingdom. See, if you're going to say that there was no death in the animal kingdom, what do you say about, this may sound like silly things, but they are things you have to think of, what do you say about when the elephant walked down to the stream or pool of water to get his drink and he steps on some insects that are in the grass and so forth? They must have been crushed. What do you say about whales that take in all this plankton and sustain themselves? You know, it's the water that strains through their whatever those sieve-like devices are called that strains out the plankton. The whole food chain is built on the feeding of one organism on another, and that, I don't think, is necessary to be viewed as part of the fall. If it were, it would raise up a whole host of other questions, so I think you have to be careful about pressing the details of this. There are a lot of questions we can ask that are difficult to answer in that area. So I'd be inclined to agree with Oswald that a figurative interpretation that speaks of conditions of removal of external danger is in view, or the point that's being made by all these specifics is leading to a single point, and that is that there is going to be no reason for fear because that will be removed by this rod that's coming out of Jesse. But let's look at another question. How do the post-mill and on-mill interpreters understand verses 6 to 9? For the post-mill view, go to page 11, and I've taken some paragraphs here from Joseph Addison Alexander's commentary on the prophecies of Isaiah. He was post-mill. He says, and I'll quote here, "Most Christian writers, ancient and modern, with Aben Ezra and Maimonides among the Jews, explain the prophecy as wholly metaphorical and descriptive of the peace to be enjoyed by God's people." End quote. In other words, in the present era of the spread of the gospel, it's a metaphorical description of peace to be enjoyed by God's people in the new dispensation. Alexander continues, quote, "Cotius and Clericus apply the passage to the external peace between the church and the world, which is commonly regarded as," notice, I emphasize here, "is commonly regarded as descriptive of the change wrought by Christianity in wicked men themselves. Vitringa gives a specific meaning to each figure in the landscape, making the lamb, the calf, and the fatted beast denote successive stages in the Christian's progress. The lion represents open enemies, the leopard more disguised ones, the wolf treacherous and malignant ones, the little child, the minister. The little child will lead them." That's the picture of the minister leading sinners into glory. Now, I have to say that this kind of exposition not only mars the beauty, but obscures the real meaning of the prophecy. Calvin and Hengstenberg suppose the passage to include the promise of a future change in the material creation. In other words, not just in men who have responded to the gospel, but in the material creation itself, restoring it to its original condition. And again, I look to Romans chapter 8, verses 19 and 22 for this. While they agree with the other writers regarding the specific effects of true religion as the primary subject of verse 7, where it says, "The cow and the bear shall feed together," and so forth. "The lion and the ox shall eat straw." For this, Alexander notes, the Tringa carries out his allegorical hypothesis by making the cow the representative of Christians who have reached the point of giving as well as receiving instruction, of yielding milk, as it were, as well as drinking it. He apologizes for the use of straw as an emblem of divine truth, or the gospel, on the ground that its doctrines are so simple and uninviting to fastidious appetites. The arbitrary character of such interpretations is betrayed by Gill's remark that straw here means true doctrine, but elsewhere it means false. See, if you start going down this route, you can put on almost any meaning you want to the various phrases here. Quoting from Gill, we read again, "The truth is that neither the straw nor the lion means anything by itself, but the lion's eating straw denotes a total change of habit and indeed of nature, and is therefore a fit emblem for," here's the way he understands it, "the revolution which the gospel, in proportion to its influence, affects in the conditions of society," and then, with some allusion possibly, as before, suggested to the ultimate deliverance of the ktesis, which is the Greek term for the irrational creation. And this ktesis is going to be saved from the bondage of corruption to which, for human sake, it is now subjected. And he goes on that the suckling child shall play on and over the hole of the ass, on the den of the basilisk, which is a dangerous snake, shall the weaned child stretch or place its hand. End quote. Let's go to the top of page 12 and read what Luther and Calvin had to say. Luther and Calvin and Huss take this as the children who were to thrust their hands into the den of the asp as anti-Christian serpents. It's really a mere continuation of the metaphor, you see, is the way they take it, beginning in verse 7, and it expresses an additional figure of the change to be effected in society by the prevalence of true religion, destroying not just influence, but rendering it possible to live in safety. The last statement, you see, is the way he views it. "They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain," and so forth. The first clause clearly shows that the foregoing description is to be figuratively understood. The wolf and the lamb should lie down together. This means, in other words, that none should hurt or destroy in the Messiah's kingdom. But Alexander, as with other post-millennialists, see conditions of peace to be brought about in society through the spread of the gospel, perhaps with some allusion to deliverance of the creation from the bondage of corruption. In other words, he's not limiting it just to relationships among people. Maybe also in some way it's going to affect the creation itself. Now, there wouldn't be that much difference, you see, between a post-mill and a pre-mill understanding of this. The difference is how these conditions are going to be established. Are they going to be established as through the spread of the gospel in the present age, or must we await the return of Christ, and he will establish it subsequent to his second return? All right, that's the post-mill position. Now, for an on-mill interpretation, let's look at pages 18 and 19 in your citations page. This is taken from E.J. Young, Volume 1, page 390, second paragraph on top of page 18 of your citation. Young says, and now I'm quoting him, "How are we to understand the words of this glorious prophecy? Some think that this passage simply depicts a return to paradise such as was taught by the ancients generally." See note 13 for references. According to the older expositors, these expressions of a change in the animal world were simply figures to express a change in man himself. So Calvin, for example, remarks by these images, the prophet indicates that among the people of Christ there will be no disposition for injuring one another, or any ferocity, or any inhumanity of one person to another. And, without question, the prophet does desire to teach that there will be a change in human nature, inasmuch as this future time, blessing will be one in which the knowledge of the Lord will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. At the same time, it must be noted that Isaiah has placed great stress upon the animals themselves. And this very fact shows that it is impossible to carry through a detail with a figurative interpretation. If all is merely figurative, what's the point of such detailed statements concerning the change in the animals? It would appear also that we have here a parallelism or comparison with the condition before the fall of man into sin. Before the entrance of sin into the world, the animals were helps of man and were named by him. All that God had made was good. Hostility between man and animals, at least, was unknown. End quote. Now, we go on. Hansenberg says rightly, I believe, and in accordance with Scripture, where there was not a Cain, neither was there a lion. May it not be that, in Isaiah's language, a lion shall eat straw like an ox, that there is a reflection upon the command and permission granted to the animals that every green herb should be to them for meat? Next paragraph on page 391, Young continues as follows. Other passages of Scripture also indicate that when evil will cease in the rational creation, the reflection of evil will disappear from the non-rational creation. That's Isaiah chapter 65, verse 25, and chapter 66, verse 22. This change in the non-rational creation implies, of course, the more wondrous change among men themselves. The animals are no longer at enmity with one another because evil has departed from men. Men will know the Lord, and the reflection of that fact appears that even among the animals there will be also a full and complete cessation of hostility. It may be noted also that even upon this more or less literal interpretation, we may not be compelled to press all the details. We need not assume that there will be physiological changes in the structure of the lion, for example. All that is clearly taught is that the animals will not prey upon one another. This is, as Hansenberg says, the outmost limit of the changes to be wrought by the blessed rule of Christ. Here there is a change. How much more among men? And that ends Young's quote at the top of page 19. Well, the question still remains, when is this change going to appear? The answer, it should be noted, that Isaiah has emphasized, is that the fact this will happen when the Messiah, the Prince of Peace, comes. When the Messiah has completed his messianic work, and here we get into this same sort of position that Young took with respect to Isaiah chapter 2, when the Messiah has completed his messianic work, peace is introduced into the hearts of men. And, insofar as men are true to the principles of peace which they received from the Messiah, so far do the blessings herein depicted obtain. So, to a degree, it is being realized now, insofar as men are true to the principles they receive from the Messiah. So, to a degree, it's being fulfilled now, this promise that Isaiah has made. In its fullness, however, this condition will not be realized until the earth is covered with the knowledge of the Lord, and that condition will obtain only in the new heavens and the new earth wherein dwell righteousness. So he is saying, in a measure, it is fulfilled now to the degree that people are faithful to the teachings of Christ. In its fullness, though, it will only be realized in the new heavens and the new earth. He tends to be, maybe not 100%, but he tends to be and to move in that direction because, Young says, what is the point of the figurative language of all the animals if it's not really going to affect the animals? Although what he is saying is that as long as there is sin, the animals are still going to be the way they are now. It's not until sin is completely removed that the animals will share in this kind of condition depicted by Isaiah. You could conclude from what he does say, but he doesn't explicitly say that, that the animals have a significance. But he says, you see, insofar as men are true to the principles of peace, so far do the blessings herein obtain. So that's qualified to a degree. Now, you can come back, you know, but he would say, well, men don't adhere completely enough to that which they should, so that we don't find those results at present. So then, you push the peaceful time into the eternal state when everybody will obey the will of Christ. Now, at the bottom of page 18 of my handout, where it says, we need not be compelled to press the details, well, that's on page 391 of Young's work. Well, no, there he says, this very fact shows it's impossible to carry through in detail a figurative interpretation. Is that the point? Oh, no, look at the next statement. If all is merely figurative, what is the point of such details? To wit, the animals. Yes, that's on page 390, just the page before. Sorry I made that mistake about my citations. Let me capitulate. You see, he is saying that the prophecy is partially fulfilled now, but completeness comes in the eternal state. This is on page 19 at the top. He goes on to say, and I'm quoting here, "Wherever there is sin," says Bracker, "there is lack of peace. Only where righteousness reigns is there peace. For this reason, the condition herein described, notice, cannot apply to a supposed millennium." End quote. That's why he rules out a millennium interpretation. Advocates of a millennial theory maintain that even during the millennium there is sin, for after the millennium the nations will gather for battle against Jesus. The picture before us, however, is one in which there is no sin, but in which the fullest manifestation of peace is to be seen. We read these words with grateful hearts, for we know that one day we too shall enjoy these blessings in their full sense, and we shall enjoy them only because of the work of Emmanuel, the one who was born from Jesse's reed, who, in the great battle of Calvary, slew the wicked in order that he gave himself a ransom for sin. To his name be all honor and praise and glory given. End quote. That's on page 391. So you ask the question, when will this prophecy be realized? The postmillennialists say that this present age, by means of the spread of the gospel, as the effects of true religion work themselves out in society, and in the creation, these things will come to pass. Alexander, whom we've quoted before, suggests that, and we noted that the great scholar Delitzsch, who was also a postmillennial, page 12 of your citation, Delitzsch says in the middle of the page, quote, "The fathers and such commentators as Luther, Calvin, and Vitringa have taken all these figures from the animal world as symbolical. Modern rationalists, on the other hand, have understood them literally, but regard the whole as a beautiful dream and wish. It is a prophecy, however," notice what he says, "it is a prophecy, however, the realization of which is to be expected on this side of the boundary between time and eternity, and, as Paul has shown in Romans 8, it is an integral link in the present predestined course of the history of salvation. There now reign among irrational creatures, from the greatest to the least, even among such as are invisible, fierce conflicts and bloodthirstiness of the most savage kind. But when the Son of David enters upon the full possession of his royal inheritance, the peace of paradise will be renewed, and all that is true in the popular legend of the Golden Age are to be realized and confirmed. This is what the prophet depicts in such lovely colors." End quote. So, postmillennialists say that the present age, by the means of the spread of the gospel, is going to accomplish this state. Amillennialists would say that partially it is accomplished in the present age because of the preaching of the gospel, but the complete fulfillment of this prophecy will be in the eternal stage, whereas premillennialists would say that these conditions will not be realized until Christ returns and establishes his kingdom, rules with a rod of iron, and establishes these conditions on earth. Now, I say that is the view of premillennialists generally. Now, J. Barton Payne has his own approach. Look at page 15 in the middle. He says, "If you have used this encyclopedia of biblical prophecy, you know he divides redemptive history into various parts, I guess you could say into periods, and he gives each period a number so that when he comes to a specific prophecy and he wants to discuss fulfillment, he can just refer to the number of that particular period that he's talking about. It's kind of an interesting scheme of doing things. And here, the period that he is referring to is period 15. But period 15 in his scheme of things is the millennium. So he says, fulfillment period 15, that's the millennium. And he goes on and says, as in Psalm 96, verse 12, the joy in nature in Christ's return, Romans 8, 21, yet, and here's the twist he puts in it, yet Scripture seems to limit the current conduct of wild beasts to their relations with men and with the domesticated animals of mankind. They're prevented from destroying in all my holy mountain. But elsewhere, lions and wolves need to be no less carnivorous than they seem to have been prior to or outside of Eden. End quote. So he's suggesting really two things here. The conditions here, he says, are limited simply to Mount Zion. After all, Isaiah says that they will neither hurt nor destroy upon my holy mountain. Elsewhere, he says, animals presumably remain as they are. But then, you see, he pulls that analogy back into Genesis and suggests that the conditions of passivity among animals, even at that time, was limited to the Garden of Eden. Outside the Garden of Eden, things presumably were as they are now generally. So it's an interesting suggestion. Well, okay, let's move on to verse 10, and I quote, "In that day there shall be a root of Jesse," end quote. See, that goes back to verse 1, continuing the quote, "who shall stand for an ensign of the peoples? To him shall the nations seek, and his rest shall be glorious," end quote. Verse 10 is a very similar passage to Isaiah chapter 2, verse 3, because Isaiah chapter 2, verse 3 speaks of the nations as coming to Zion. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 3 says, and I quote, "And many people shall go and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem," end quote. You see, here we have this root of Jesse, who will be an ensign to the peoples. To him shall the nations seek. And then the verse ends with the phrase, "his rest shall be glorious." The Latin Vulgate translates that as sepulcher. "His sepulcher shall be glorious." His rest, sepulcher, the root meaning of sepulcher, meaning rest, and took that to be a prediction of the glory of the Holy Sepulcher in Jerusalem, which has been a traditional Roman Catholic interpretation. But if you look at the use of that word, rest, in the Hebrew, it's never used in the sense of a sepulcher. It speaks of a place where there is rest, and it seems much better to understand this in connection with the words of Christ, who said in Matthew chapter 11, verse 28, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." So the nations shall seek this one who will come, and his rest will be glorious. In Christ they will find rest. Okay, question or comments on this? Well, let's go on. Isaiah 11, verses 1 to 10, is a well-known passage, and certainly one that is of great interest. In my own view, it's one that speaks of the millennial period. Question, yes. The question is, what is a sepulcher? Answer, it's a tomb. The Church of the Holy Sepulcher in Jerusalem is presumably the site of the place where Jesus was buried. There's a lot of dispute among that, but mainly the archaeological evidence and the historical evidence points to that particular location. We read that Jesus was crucified outside of the walls of Jerusalem, and that he was placed in a garden tomb outside the city, which many think is in this location, which, by the way, is in the present city wall of Jerusalem, but at the time of Jesus, this location would have been outside of the city wall of Jerusalem. But in answer to your question, a sepulcher is a resting place. Student interjects something that we don't quite understand. Sepulcher? Answer, I'm not sure. It wouldn't surprise me if it is. I'm not sure of the etymology of sepulcher, but the Latin Vulgate translated this as a burial place, sepulcher, rather than just rest. Okay, let's take 10 minutes now, take a break, and then we'll look at the last part of the chapter when we meet again. That's the end of lecture number 8 by Robert Vinoy on the major prophets, specifically Isaiah.